All right, let's dive into some really interesting legal territory today. We're going to be taking a deep dive into Dennis v. United States, a landmark First Amendment case that ultimately went to the Supreme Court. And this case really puts us right in the middle of the Cold War period, a time when the fear of communism was really gripping America.
It did. And you can really see that tension kind of play out in this case, right? You've got, on the one hand, you've got the Smith Act of 1940, which actually made it a crime to advocate for the violent overthrow of the government. But then on the other hand, you have the First Amendment, which guarantees freedom of speech. So, you know, it's really a classic clash between national security and individual liberty.
So could you set the scene for us a little bit more? Who were the main players in this whole drama?
Sure. So we've got 11 leaders of the Communist Party of the USA, and they were charged with conspiring to violate the Smith Act. I mean, just think about that for a second, right? They were convicted, essentially, for advocating for a certain ideology, not for any actual violent actions.
Wow. So they were convicted for their beliefs, not their actions. That's a pretty intense place to start from. And did this actually go to trial?
Oh, yeah. It went to a 9-month trial. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Yeah. And it gets even more interesting because the judge actually told the jury to disregard whether the defendant's actions posed a real threat.
Really?
Yeah, they were to focus only on their intent. So, I mean, even that instruction right there brings up a lot of serious questions about fairness, right? And about how we interpret free speech.
Yeah, well, it sounds like thought crime, right?
Yeah.
Like just the idea of holding these dangerous thoughts is enough to get you convicted.
Yeah.
So they were found guilty then at the trial. What happened after that?
Well, they appealed, of course.
Right.
And you can probably guess this whole, you know, battle between national security and free speech eventually landed at the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court. I mean, the stakes were incredibly high because the court had to decide if the Smith Act, which was designed to protect the government, you know, if that actually went against the very First Amendment that it was supposed to be upholding.
Right. So what did the court, what was the outcome of this battle of ideas, I guess you could say?
So in a 6-2 ruling, they upheld the convictions.
Wow.
They said that the Smith Act was constitutional. And this is where Judge Learned Hand's reformulation of the clear and present danger test comes into play. And that's a really important part of this whole thing.
So could you break down that clear and present danger test for us? How did that actually play into the court's decision?
Okay, so the original clear and present danger test basically said that speech could be restricted if it presented a clear and present danger of some imminent lawless action, right? But Hand's version of this, it added this whole new dimension. He said that you have to weigh the gravity of the evil, you know, against how likely it is to happen. So even if the probability of, let's say, a violent overthrow of the government, you know, even if that seemed low, the sheer gravity of that potential harm could be enough to justify restricting speech.
Oh, okay. So the more disastrous, I guess, the potential outcome, the less immediate the threat needs to be to actually restrict the speech. That's a pretty intense concept. Can you give us an example to help illustrate this a little more?
Sure. So imagine someone is advocating for a huge terrorist attack. Even if it seems like they're not really able to actually carry it out, the potential for just massive loss of life, you know, the potential for disrupting society so much, that could be enough under this test to restrict their speech.
Yeah, that is unsettling, I gotta say. I mean, where do we draw the line there? At what point does talking about something actually become a threat?
I mean, that is the core of this debate. And it's why Dennis is, it's such a landmark case. You know, the majority opinion basically argued that the Smith Act wasn't about punishing people for like just abstract thoughts or theoretical discussions.
Right.
They said that it required proof of intent to actually incite action, not just, you know, casually talking about revolution or something.
Okay, so the government didn't need to wait for a revolution to actually break out before taking action. Mm-hmm. Just the intent to start something was enough.
Well, that's how the court interpreted the law. But keep in mind, this wasn't a unanimous decision. The dissenting justices, they had some, you know, some pretty strong arguments against this majority opinion. What about all this strikes you as the most compelling so far?
To be honest, I'm a little worried about the idea of punishing someone just for what they believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like that could lead us down a pretty slippery slope. What were the dissenting justices' main points against the majority opinion.
Yeah, you really hit the nail on the head with that slippery slope idea.
Okay.
That's exactly what bothered the dissenting justices, too. Justice Black, he was a fierce defender of free speech, and he saw the Smith Act as a very clear violation of the First Amendment. He basically argued that it boiled down to something called prior restraint, which means punishing like the expression of ideas themselves rather than any actual actions.
Prior restraint, that sounds like a pretty big deal. Could you explain exactly what that means and why it's so important in free speech cases?
Sure. So prior restraint is basically when the government tries to like stop speech before it's even said, as opposed to punishing it after the fact. It's considered like one of the most serious threats to free speech because it really discourages people from speaking out, right? And that can stop important ideas from ever even reaching the public. And Justice Black saw the Smith Act as this kind of prior restraint because it made it a crime to just advocate for certain ideas. You know, it didn't matter if those ideas ever led to any actual action.
So Black was basically saying that the First Amendment should protect like all speech unless it directly leads to violence, like right away.
Uh-huh.
So advocating for some ideology, even if it's, potentially dangerous, shouldn't be a crime in and of itself.
Exactly. And Justice Douglas, he was another dissenter, and he had some similar concerns. He pointed out that there really wasn't any evidence that showed, like, any imminent harm from these defendants, mm-hmm. and he worried about what this conviction would mean for people speaking out against the government and just for open debate in general.
Okay, so it seems like both Black and Douglas felt like the majority opinion was, it leaned too far towards security and might have ended up sacrificing some really core First Amendment principles in the process.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. They were really concerned about the precedent that this case set. You know, they were worried that this could end up leading to suppressing views that were unpopular or dissenting. This whole case really, it highlights that tension that always exists between security and liberty, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it's a tension that we're still dealing with today, right? I mean, just think about all the debates that we have about hate speech and extremism online and the government watching everything we do.
Absolutely. You know, Dennis might be, it might be a product of that Cold War era, but the questions that it raises about how far free speech can go and the balance between security and individual rights, I mean, those are timeless questions, really.
So how did Dennis actually affect things legally? Did it lead to like a lot of censorship and people being silenced for speaking out?
Well, Dennis definitely gave the government more power to go after individuals and groups that they saw as threats during the Cold War.
Right.
And it really created an atmosphere of fear and self-censorship, especially among people with more left-leaning political views.
It almost seems like even though the court said you need to prove an intent to incite action, the practical effect was still that people felt like they couldn't speak freely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But the story doesn't end there. The way we interpret free speech, legally speaking, I mean, it's always changing.
Right.
And in 1969, we had Brandenburg v. Ohio. That case marked a pretty significant change in how the court approached this.
Okay, and Brandenburg v. Ohio, well, that's going to be our next deep dive. But can you just give us a little preview? How did that case change the playing field that Dennis created?
So Brandenburg, it set a much higher bar for when you could restrict speech. The court came up with this imminent lawless action test, and this test requires the government to prove that the speech is both aimed at causing like immediate lawless action and that it's likely to actually make that action happen.
Oh, so it's not enough to just express ideas that are, hateful or dangerous. There has to be like a clear and present danger that those words are going to lead to illegal actions right away.
Exactly. So Brandenburg really narrowed down the scope of Dennis. It made it a lot harder for the government to restrict speech just based on what was being said.
Okay.
You know, to meet this imminent lawless action standard, the speech has to be more than just advocating for violence, like in a theoretical sense. There needs to be a direct connection between the words and a real and immediate threat of violence.
Got it. So could you maybe give us an example to help us really understand this new standard?
Sure. Let's say someone gives a speech and they're, advocating for violence against a certain group of people.
Okay. Now, under Brandenburg, that speech wouldn't be punishable unless it also unless it also got the audience to actually go out and commit violence right then.
Right.
And there had to be a real chance that the audience would actually do that.
Oh, okay.
So the context of the speech and how immediate the potential harm was, those things became a lot more important.
So it sounds like Brandenburg basically gave more breathing room for free speech and made it harder to just shut down dissenting voices just because of what they were saying. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Brandenburg was a real turning point. It showed that there was a growing understanding that even speech that's offensive or unpopular, it still deserves protection under the First Amendment. But like all legal stuff, right, you know, it's not always so black and white. Even with this Brandenburg test, courts still run into really difficult cases that push the limits of free speech.
So what kind of cases, really test those boundaries? What challenges does the imminent lawless action test face now in the world we live in today?
Well, think about the internet, right? How do we apply that imminent lawless action test to what people say online?
Right.
You know, messages online can spread so quickly, and they could potentially lead to violence across, you know, different countries.
Right.
Or how do we handle hate speech that might not actually meet the Brandenburg standard for directly causing violence immediately, but it still creates this environment of fear and intolerance?
Those are some really tough questions. It shows just how complicated and nuanced the whole relationship between free speech and the law is.
Okay.
We've come a long way since those Cold War anxieties that led to Dennis, but the challenge of balancing free expression with security and keeping society harmonious, I mean, those challenges are still with it. It seems like we're always going to be like walking this tightrope between between free speech and security. But I guess understanding these cases like Dennis, that's got to be important, right? What can we really learn from Dennis as we try to, you know, navigate these ongoing challenges?
Well, I think one of the biggest takeaways from Dennis is that, you know, how we understand basic rights legally, you know, even something as fundamental as free speech, that's not set in stone.
Right.
Yeah. It can change depending on, you know, the social and political worries of the time.
So you're saying that even the Supreme Court, like the ultimate protector of our rights, they can be influenced by like the fears and pressures of the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Judges, I mean, they're human too, right? Mm-hmm. They're shaped by their own experiences and by what's going on in society and politics at the time. So it reminds us that even our most, you know, treasured rights, they're constantly being reinterpreted and reevaluated as society changes.
Yeah. That's a pretty humbling thought. It makes you wonder how future generations are going to look back at our legal system. You know, what will they think we were blind to?
That's a fascinating question to think about, isn't it? I mean, maybe future generations will they'll look back at our anxieties about terrorism and online extremism and all the political fighting that we have, and they'll wonder how all that shaped how we saw free speech. Maybe they'll think we were too quick to restrict speech in the name of security, or maybe they'll see us as kind of naive for not, you know, recognizing new threats that were emerging.
It's almost like we're stuck in this constant back and forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to balance the need for safety with protecting individual liberties. Does that tension ever really go away?
I don't think the conversation about free speech ever truly ends. You know, it's it's this ongoing discussion, this constant balancing act. And as new technologies pop up and social norms change, I mean, we're always having to rethink where that line is between freedom and restrictions.
It's not enough to just like rely on what's happened in the past legally or on legal doctrines, right? We have to actively take part in this discussion.
Absolutely. It's, you know, we all have a responsibility to be informed citizens, to understand our rights and to participate in, you know, thoughtful conversations about how to balance those rights with other important values in society.
So you're saying that protecting free speech isn't just the job of the courts or the government, right? It's a shared responsibility. We all have to be involved.
Exactly.
With
we can't just sit back and watch. We need to be actively shaping the future of free speech in our society. And, you know, that means being willing to really understand the complexities and to engage in, you know, respectful debate and to grapple with those tough questions that come up when individual liberties clash with what society as a whole is worried about.
Well said.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Dennis v. United States, I'm feeling a mix of caution and optimism, you know.
Yeah.
Caution because we've seen how fear and anxiety can really chip away at basic freedoms.
but optimism, because we've also seen how the legal system can adapt and evolve to protect those freedoms better.
And that's what's so great about the American legal system. It's not just stuck in the past. It's meant to respond to changing times and to really grapple with those tough questions of balancing competing values. You know, the conversation about free speech might never really be over, but that ongoing dialogue that's absolutely crucial to having a free and democratic society that's healthy.
That's a great point. Well, everyone, that's it for our deep dive into Dennis v. United States. We hope you found this exploration insightful and something to really think about. Keep those minds sharp and be sure to join us next time as we dig into Brandenburg v. Ohio and see how the court changed how it defined protected speech in the years after Dennis.